show on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
It's the new ASMR show.
It sure is. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
And yeah, it's kind of hard to get out of that quiet mode. It's, you know, just, you know, when you're ensconced in the quiet and...
Yes,
it feels wrong to be loud.
I find whispering difficult on my hearing, so I won't be doing it.
Okay, well, I'll do the whispering.
No. You'll find out why in a minute. End credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror movie, A Quiet Place. And it was very quiet. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to do some news and talk about some of the things that happened in pop culture this past week, including the creators of Westworld. They played a very tricky trick on us and saying they were going to release all the spoilers for the second season of the show in advance. But is that as crazy as it sounds? I don't know. And then we're going to talk about the problem with Apu, the stalwart owner of the Quickie Mart on The Simpsons, and he's long been seen as an Indian American stereotype, but now the show is being attacked because of it. So can we make Apu politically correct? I don't know, but first, there was a bit of hysteria last week as it was announced that Damian Lewis was going to play the late Rob Ford in some kind of political thriller based on the former mayor of Toronto's exploits, except that's kind of not what it's about. It's funny how quickly this went awry. Because I think it was in the Hollywood Reporter, it was announced that this gentleman, Ricky Tolman, who, this is kind of like his first big project, it's called Run This Town, and he's the writer and director, and it's kind of loosely based on Rob Ford, although not really, because they're filming it in Toronto. It is starring a ton of Canadian people, including Ben Platt, who plays the reporter who's trying to expose the mayor, and Mina Mossad and Nina Dobrev as two staffers who are working for the mayor, trying to keep him in line. Scott Speedman is co-starring, as is Gil Bellows. Those are two fine Canadian lads. Damian Lewis, although, is playing a caricature of Rob, or like some sort of Rob Ford pastiche, let's say, apparently did undergo prosthetic fitting, so he's going to be made old or bald or fat. This was an hilarious line. I think I got it from the Toronto Star, if I can find it. Yes, they called Damian Lewis notably sleeker in figure than the late mayor. Damian Lewis, if you guys don't know, he's on Homeland. He's well known for Homeland and now Billions, and very not in the Rob Ford mold, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. If only this was a video show of some type, people would see. I have been vociferously shaking my head this whole time.
Yeah, that's true.
That I have nothing to say because it's just, what do they say on the internet, the kids? SMH? Just SMH. Over and over. Like, what? Every single part of this is just what?
Yeah.
What is with this casting? What is with this story? Why are you telling this story? Mm-hmm. Why are you trying to make the Rob Ford character more of an empathetic character? Why are you making this a story about a millennial man reporter who is out there to get the story? Why have you created two staffers who are women who are trying to basically do emotional labor for the wacky mayor? Why? All of it. SMH.
That's a great question.
Those were seven questions.
Yeah.
I don't know, roughly.
but no, yeah, they're all great questions. I will disagree about making Rob Ford sympathetic. Because I do have a bit of a soft spot for Rob Ford. I think this is getting into political territory. Mm-hmm.
Well, it can't not, really.
But I do feel like he was someone who got into politics for, you know, not necessarily the typical reasons, but, you know, his heart, I think, was in the right place. Was he always refined? No. Was he maybe a tad on the racist and misogynist side? Yeah, absolutely.
A tad, yeah.
I'm trying to be generous, but...
Yeah, no, and I agree with you in that certainly he was a human being who,
yeah,
I believe was led astray by family members.
Absolutely.
A fair amount. He was very yes. much used by his family to push their own agenda. And that's all I'll say on that. And he was certainly, you know, he had illnesses. And
yeah.
yes, I can agree to all of those things. It doesn't make his misogyny and his racism okay.
No, of course not.
and for that reason, I will always just say, sure, yeah, okay. Yes, these human reasons make you maybe... You know,
but he's not Trump. You know, a lot of people want to make that comparison. But, you know, Trump, I don't get a sense that Trump would get on the phone and talk to constituents is my
True.
Feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that does make all the difference. To go back to your other point, though, about like making this about millennial life post recession.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ben Platt, I feel kind of sorry for him because he's a working actor who took a part.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had to issue like an official press release that's like, look, I'm not playing Robin Doolittle, guys. We are not gender switching Robin Doolittle. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, because everyone knows who Robin Doolittle is, and they know the role she plays. She literally yeah. wrote the book on it, so it's
literally
it's a little hard to swallow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I always thought Nina Dobrev would have made a good Robin Doolittle in a
yeah right.
In a movie,
Why is
so.
She in this yeah, role where she's actually right. running around now? And the other problem is that. Did we just need a Canadian version of House of Cards? Like, is that what's going on here? Because it sort of seemed like the first season of House of Cards is basically, if I were to take the sort of Rob Ford-ness out of it and mm-hmm. I just read sort of this plot synopsis, I would go, yeah, I saw that. It was the first season of House of Cards. Mm. Like, what? Why are we doing this? I don't understand why we need this story told.
I can't wait to see Damian Lewis push Ben Platt in front of a train. spoilers for House of Cards. There is that too. And there's also, why can't you just do the Rob Ford movies? Like, yeah, you don't own the rights to Crazy Town. I can't remember who did. Like, but like a Canadian production company like snapped up mm-hmm. the rights almost immediately after the book came out. But Rob Ford was a public figure. Everyone involved is a public figure. You can just do the Rob Ford story.
Yep.
That story is absolutely appealing, and it can be told in such a way where you can humanize Rob Ford and still talk about the great investigative work done by people like Robin Doolittle and Kevin Donovan mm-hmm. and Daniel Dale, who his profile has gone up. It would still be timely in a way, too. You're shooting in Toronto anyway. Just
yeah. And just, again, to get a little political, I do find the timing of this is not good right now
mm-hmm.
when Rob Ford's brother is mm-hmm. literally campaigning for high office in Ontario, right? Mm-hmm. And so why are a bunch of artists or you know, a production company creating extra media for... Mm-hmm. someone running for political office? Like, are they just completely unaware of that fact? They just didn't think that it would sort of spill over into free media?
Well, I mean, it depends. You know, you and I both know that sometimes all the things just lock into place, and when it's time
it's
to
true.
Go, it's time
yeah.
to go.
Yeah.
When you're making a film. But you're not wrong. It's,
yeah.
And I'm actually surprised. I don't think there has been an official comment from the Ford camp about it.
No.
Which is surprising.
Might be the smartest thing they've done.
Might be. speaking of smart moves, this may not be one of them. The creators of Westworld, of the TV show, Jonathan Nolan, and his writing partner, an actual partner, Lisa Joy, did a Reddit AMA where they were talking about the new season of the show. I think it premieres later this month. And they were saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do a 20-minute video, and we're going to release it online. It's going to have all the spoilers for the second season. And everyone was like, oh, that sounds dumb. And but a lot of people in the aftermath are saying, like, well, first of all, it didn't happen. They did a Rickroll. But a lot of people in the aftermath are saying, like, are we really this far off where, you know, people are so desperate to know the details, they'll literally just, like, avoid having to sit through, like, 8, 10, 13 episodes of a thing to just get to the meaty stuff?
So the reality is that there are always people who do want to know the spoilers. There are people who actually prefer their entertainment if they know what's coming. I mean, I've been part of the online world of fandom since The X-Files in 1995. So believe
you had an Alta Vista page, didn't you?
I did not, but I might have had a page on some web ring somewhere. But so online spoilers have really opened the door for people who really do want their entertainment that way. There are lots of people who really want it. And so most of the spoilers that people get really do actually come from the production companies anyways. Yeah. You know, they're just leaked quietly. Mm-hmm. So the idea of them doing this, releasing a 20-minute, it's just like, you know what? We're just going to do it. We know everybody wants it anyways, or those that do want it are going to go find it, or we'll have to do this convoluted little thing. So let's just release it, and then you can either choose to watch it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand why nobody anticipated the prank video that came out as opposed to the spoiler video that came out.
Yeah, I think it was too stupid to not be true, I think a lot of people thought. And, you know, the thing of it is, yeah, it used to be a pretty rich spoiler culture, but I think a lot of productions have done a lot to kind of lock that stuff down now. So, yeah, anything that kind of gets spoiler is kind of like and something that's intentionally kind of launched. Unless you happen to get lucky and you turn down the wrong corner in Vancouver one day and you
stumble upon the episode of Flash being
filmed.
Yeah,
and you see, yeah, or something like that. I mean, that was a big thing with The 100 a couple of seasons ago, that there was a spoiler and they were shooting the final episode and they were they took the unusual step of actually shooting it in downtown Vancouver because it was of the plot necessity, and there was a certain character that turned up that got a lot of people excited, and then that character turned out to circumstances that the character was actually written out, and because this was a virtual reality, the character appeared again and people were upset about the circumstances. That's kind of like a rare instance, though. The thing about Westworld, and I know you didn't watch Westworld.
Mm-hmm. Though it's not on purpose, just because I just didn't get a chance to, and I'd like to. And now that I've read about the video they released, I'm like, these people are right up my alley. I definitely want to watch the show.
Yeah, I think the problem with I don't think it was a fan problem, because there were a lot of fans who speculate things. And I followed Star Trek Discovery all the way through as it was coming on TV. And there were people who guessed the spoilers in that, too. A lot of sharp people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would read that on Twitter and I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. And then it turned out to be correct. I don't think it's that my enjoyment at all. It just, I think the Nolan and Joy were kind of putting the blame on the fans, like, you're so obsessive, you know, you just want this, you're vultures, or I don't know what they were thinking, but there's kind of no onus on them for kind of what a lot of people have said is like building the mystery box so shabbily that people were able to guess within, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 episodes where the plot was going, and that's not the fans' fault.
No. Well, and to be fair, it's not necessarily the creator's fault either, right? Like, stories follow, you know,
rhythms.
Yes, exactly. And you can kind of tell things. Like, if for the entertainment to be enjoyable, you want something to not come right out of the blue. You know, I remember watching Veronica Mars, and I really loved Veronica Mars, but I still have issues with a couple of character arcs that I'm like, okay, you were building this character, and then just like that, the character changed dramatically because you needed it for your story, and it was not part of the story.
Mm.
The person who actually killed Lily, I'm like, nope, I don't buy that. None of that was present until you needed it to be in the last like 3 episodes. So I mean, I don't think it's a problem if people are creating a story that actually does give you hints of where it's going. That's that's good storytelling.
Yeah. I think the problem with Westworld, though, was that, and I did watch Westworld all the way through the first season, and I think the problem was it was very mystery box focused versus something like, they made the comparison to Game of Thrones, that the fact that Game of Thrones had 5 big spoiler-filled tomes, which were the books the show was based on out there, didn't affect anyone's enjoyment of the show. And it's like, well, that's technically true. But, you know, if you're someone like me who was watching Game of Thrones, like, these are based on books, I'm going to go and check them out. And then you walk into the bookshelf and it's like 5,000 pages long per book. And you're like,
I'll just stick with the show.
Yeah.
Thanks.
10 episodes a season. No problem. But the thing with Westworld was it was very mystery box focused. And Game of Thrones, despite the fact that, you know, it's a big, great big universe with a lot of story going on, is actually fairly character focused, or at least most of those early seasons were. I make the comparison more to Lost, oddly enough, another J.J. Abrams show, which started out very character focused. And then at some point, I think around season three, it became more, oh, we got to figure out the island.
Time.
Yeah, when we like literally changed time and everyone's in different time zones. And then at the end, the creators were like, oh, no, it was always about character all along. It's like, no, it really wasn't. You kind of took a turn to the left and said, no, this island has stuff to tell you that we're never going to tell you. And I think that's the fine line, is if you're making it about character, people aren't focused on the mysteries. But when you're saying, like, here are mysteries to solve and the characters aren't purely in service of solving mysteries, then...
Humans are inquisitive. They will work to solve the mystery.
Bold comment.
I mean, not all of them. There are some of them who definitely, maybe half and half. Half humans are inquisitive. The other half are happy to just let
stuff happen.
Yep.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Speaking of stuff happening, you may have heard of a show called The Simpsons.
Sorry, what show?
The Simpsons.
Oh, first time I heard of it.
It's been around longer than probably many of our listeners have been alive.
Don't remind me. Because that means I've been around longer than many of the listeners have been alive.
Oh, ditto. So there was an episode last week where they were addressing a controversy. And the controversy actually started last year. A comedian named Hari Kondabula made a documentary called The Problem with Apu, and he's an Indian American, and it was about how he grew up with, you know, these stereotypes perpetuated, unfortunately, by this character Apu in The Simpsons, who's the proprietor of the Quickie Mart. And he talks to a number of other Indian American comedians about that, like Aziz Ansari and Kumar Bell, and he's basically making the point, like, this is a character, the most well-known Indian American character in mass media, and this is our representation, because he's almost the only Indian American character in American mass media. So The Simpsons finally addressed this last week, The Simpsons itself, in the show, and it's Marge reading a book to Lisa called The Princess in the Garden, which I guess is some kind of take on The Secret Garden. But Marge has basically woke it for modern audiences.
And the word that's a verb now? Okay.
Maybe. Lisa says to Marge, this new Clara, who is the main character of the book, sounds like she starts out pretty perfect, but since she's already evolved, she doesn't really have an emotional journey to complete. That kind of means there's no point to the book. And then that continues.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
It's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?
Some things will be dealt with at a later date.
If at all.
Kind of
nothing.
Flippant.
It means you can do nothing. You just deal with it. Just get over it.
Yeah, it's tricky. That was kind of my thought, too. It's like, you know, we're kind of raging at Apu now. And it's not like he's been a two-dimensional character. Like, all he does is say, thank you, come again. And, I mean, we're two white people talking about this, so what do we know? But there has been some effort to create depth in him. And, you know, I was thinking of, in particular, I can't remember what season it is. There have been so many. But the one where, for some reason, they're trying to get all the immigrants out of Springfield. Mm-hmm. And so Apu has to take a citizenship exam. And... with Homer's unhelpful help, of course. But it's the point of that episode is about, like, the mass ignorance of people in Spring, which a lot of
Simpsons
episodes are.
The ones who were just born there, they don't need a means test to see if they can stay.
Right, right. And, you know, so Apu's been able to be a gateway in addressing white, or in The Simpsons case, yellow issues of racism. Mm-hmm. So he's not... of course, not a perfect character, but he's not, I don't think, a stereotype. But I'm speaking as someone who is an Indian and Canadian. So
I mean, you're right. It's challenging. It's definitely challenging for you and I to talk about, because obviously I've never, you know, I've never had to live any of the experiences. So I read, you know, a number of Indian Americans and even Indian Canadians who, of course, have had to deal with people, you know, saying Apu quotes and things like that to them. And I get it, like, that's obviously a problem, and it's been a problem right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I do find the response from The Simpsons, I don't know, I mean, that might be just the beginning of the response, and maybe they are going to continue working on it.
Yeah.
Because they do have a character, and he is a lovable character, and there is things you can do. You can actually take this opportunity to introduce things. And the reality is that a lot of Indian Americans and Indian Canadians do share that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know, and I read stories about people saying, you know, I enjoyed Apu because I watched it and I saw my family doing that. So there is a way to fix this. Mm-hmm. The Simpsons has an opportunity to fix this, to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think about here in Canada, we have Kim's Convenience.
Yeah.
Right? Which is about a Korean-Canadian family who owns a convenience store.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are some, you know, sort of broad generalizations, but if you have the right people working on it, you can make broad generalizations that are loving and inclusive, as opposed to the kind that just make you the butt of the joke.
Right.
And I think that's part of the problem, too,
right,
that it's Hank Azaria, who's excellent,
yeah,
but it is a white person who is doing the character.
And yes.
And likely there are no, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the writing room looks like in Matt Groening's world, but it's entirely possible that there are no Indian Americans or Korean Americans or any other.
I do wonder if that could help solve it. It's like inviting, you know, some of these guys to into the room and say, like, okay, you know, you have a problem with Apu. How can we make Apu better? Or like saying, like, you know, let's dedicate an episode to Apu by having like someone like Aziz Ansari or what's his name from Cal Penn. You know, he was another one that featured in that documentary, saying, you know, hey, you know, tell us, you know, tell your Apu story. That's, you know, maybe outside of what's going on in the Quickie Mart or you know, any number of directions you want to take Apu. The other thing I think is that the point, although flippant, I mean, as kind of the Simpsons tone, is that, like, well, how can we solve this? Do we put Apu on a boat and, like, does he go to the same place that, you know, Lionel Hutz and and other characters go? Like, you know, does, you know, what do we do with this character? Because I think that, you know, suddenly if Apu isn't there anymore and suddenly it's, you know, Kenny who runs the Quickie Mart,
yeah,
does that
it's
make
a whole
the problem
different
better?
Problem. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's tricky. And I think what that clip was trying to say is, like, you know what, we're not going to solve this in a day, because also the fact that The Simpsons being an animated show is done, you know, so far out, it, you know, it has to be drawn. To my knowledge, it's still much of it is still drawn by hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, this is kind of the immediate response.
Yeah, I'm surprised they were able to have a response so quickly,
yeah,
in quotation marks.
And, you know, it doesn't address the core problem that there isn't a lot of representation for Indian Americans on TV. And a lot of other Indian American portrayals are just as problematic. And I was reading an NPR piece, and they brought up Raj from The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, that's a... He's... Yeah.
Which is... He's an...
I mean, every character on The Big Bang Theory is a problem.
Right.
For different reasons.
But he's the one without a permanent... Yeah. Female in his life. He's the one who, you know, is every Indian stereotype, every kind of like racialized stereotype, because he's the only person of color on that show. So it's hard to, you know, it's hard to say Apu, point at Apu and say Apu is the root of all racism. Again, in keeping the fact that he is sort of the biggest example of Indian American portrayal on television, but still, it's, you know, the way to solve it, I think, is more representation, and, you know,
maybe
bring
agree.
In another Indian American character who, you know, doesn't own a Quickie Mart or is, you know, there are a number of problematic characters on The Simpsons. I'm sure there are a lot of Jewish people who could make some very pointed references to some of the stuff Krusty the Clown's done.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right? It started, of course, you know, satirizing these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And then eventually it stops being satire and becomes the norm.
Yes. And I mean, and that's been an organic thing through the show, mm-hmm. is because it was used to be about these five people called the Simpsons. And then it's ballooned to something. This isn't an accurate number, but it's got to be at least 347 yeah. different characters.
I would have guessed at least 300. Yeah.
At various stages. And it's, yeah, it's not easy. But it, I think the point here is that they were trying to make is like, we will not, we cannot solve this in a day. And perhaps they were doing it a bit tongue in cheek. And I can understand why that excuse does not sit well mm-hmm. with some of the people who have the problems yeah. with a poo that the problems yeah. with a poo people have.
Either way, I'm glad we are all talking about it now.
Oh, sure.
Let's talk about all the problems with all the things and accept that some of them won't be fixed.
Yeah.
Some of them might just have to be deleted entirely. And some of them can be fixed, and some of them we just recognize.
Mm-hmm. Molly Ringwald might have something to say about that, too. But that's for another day. We got to talk about A Quiet Place. And before we talk about A Quiet Place, I feel like we should... A Quiet Place. Anyway.
Do I have to whisper the whole rest of the show?
No, it's fine. Anyway. This isn't even going to be quiet music. So we're just going to play a little Quiet Riot. Seemed apropos. This is Put Up or Shut Up from their 32-year-old album, QR3.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, both campus and community radio. Bet you didn't think I could find a clip for A Quiet Place, but I did. that had plenty
lots
of sound
noise
in it. Taught you guys. Anyway, that was a clip from A Quiet Place, the new film from John Krasinski, and it stars Krasinski and his real-life wife, Emily Blunt, along with Millicent Simmons, Noah Jupe, Cade Woodward, and Leon Ransom. And that is actually the entire
cast.
That's
literally everybody in the film. Everybody.
Right. And I think this was a good one, Candace.
Oh, my. So I'm sure listeners have figured it out over the time that horror is my favorite genre of film. In fact, I'm proudly wearing one of my horror podcast T-shirts today that I love, Faculty of Horror, if you want to know more about the academia of horror. So I was pretty excited.
You lost me at academia, but go ahead.
No. There's real academia about horror films, and I can't wait for them to cover this film because this was really it was so well done,
mm-hmm.
and it was there's so many things I loved about this. I was very excited that I got to watch a horror film and that it was so good. I walked out of the theater and went, okay, I'm going to watch that again. And then I went home and I upgraded to a Super Scene ticket.
Cineplex appreciates the plug. Yeah, I could see it again. I mean, it's 90 minutes. It's a tight 90 minutes.
That's the thing I love about horror films, too. They know exactly how long they're supposed to be.
Right. And, yeah, it's the interesting thing about it, too, structurally, it's kind of like maybe 30 minutes of setup and introducing to the family, and then kind of like the last scene is about an hour long, mm-hmm. about what happens.
Yeah, the climax.
Yeah, and it's I don't think it's a surprise or necessarily a spoiler that the Emily Blunt character is pregnant, and that scene we played is when it was in the trailers that she's in the bathtub hiding while she's in labor.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the main sequence of the film. That last hour is the family has gone its kind of separate ways to go about their daily routine, and now they the monsters are at the door and watching how they figure how to get out of that situation.
Yeah. So one of the many things that I love about this film, and it's funny because I had just talked about it earlier that day when I recorded the Village podcast with The Bookshelf. We talked about the problem with...
That's enough plugs.
Post-apocalyptic stories and how basically post-apocalyptic stories, books, movies, television shows, it's just survival, constant survival, survival, survival.
Yeah.
And it's like, when are these people going to stop trying to survive and actually decide how they're going to live from this point forward?
Right.
And this movie has, it opens up, and it's shortly after whatever event happened, and we, you know, sort of sets the scene. We find out it seems like they're sort of still in survival mode. But then by the second sort of, you know, after the opening credits, then it's like day 400 and whatever. So they've been living in this for over a year, and they have now moved on, and they now now exist. This is their new normal. This is the life that they lead. And as you say, you know, they've split up because they're going about their daily routines of doing the laundry and going to hunt and gather the food and doing all these things that are normal behaviors for living and trying to thrive in this.
That's always my problem with The Walking Dead, although I haven't watched it in a couple of years, but it's about going from crisis to crisis to crisis. And, you know, you go from zombie horde to horde of horrible human beings and back again. And, you know, there's no time to, like, stop and think. And you know, there's a really great scene in this where the Emily Blunt character comes down where John Krasinski's, like, workshop is, where he's trying to work out this cochlear implant for his daughter, who's deaf, and the actress Millicent, what are her names? Millicent Simmons. She is actually very deaf in real life as well. But she comes downstairs, and they have this cute little moment where she's kind of dressed up, and they have a joke that, you know, she looks fat, and like, no, I wasn't going to say anything. And then they have this nice little slow dance while they're listening to music in earbuds. And, you don't get that stuff in a lot of post-apocalyptic because it's about
it's about family. I mean, this really is a story about a family, loving each other, protecting each other, and figuring out how to communicate when the normal communication methods are gone. And what's interesting about the Emily Blunt character being pregnant is that that had to have happened. The conception happened after whatever thing happened.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like day 460, whatever.
Yeah.
And generally women carry four.
She hasn't been pregnant for a year and a half.
No. So it's so interesting to say, like, they're in this, you know, whatever, and yet they've still been able to lovingly come together as a couple while still being worried about the protection of their children. And I'm sure they didn't plan to get pregnant because I'm sure it was certainly nobody really wants to bring up a child in this. But that's the interesting thing. It's like life goes on. And how do we do this now?
And there's never a moment where they're like, oh, can you believe we're doing this? Which is something that also has a lot of these. It shows them like actually making preparations, and they're building like the soundproof room and in the basement of the house. And, you know, the kids are involved by putting up paper to buffer it. And they have this like, this crib that has like a seal on it, so when the baby cries and the oxygen mask.
Yeah.
Which is kind of terrifying too in its own way.
I'm sure the whole thing is terrifying. I mean, just in case you haven't seen the trailers or know anything about it, what's happening is that there are these monsters that can't see, can't smell, but they can hear.
They have big ears.
Any noise attracts them, and then they're 100% killing machines. Right. Like, there's no survival, period,
yeah.
if the monster hears.
Yeah, which is why you see them in the trailer walking on sand barefoot. And when they do have to go into the house, the house has footprints painted on the floor to show you where to walk, where so you don't hit the a creek. And I mean, all that stuff is just magnificently done. The world building in this is really incredible. Even right down to like small details, like that first scene you're talking about where they're scavenging for food and they're in the store and you see this, it goes from aisle to aisle and most of the shelves are empty, but you see this one row where the shelves are full. And what are they? The potato chips.
Very, very loud. Yeah. Even just opening the bag is a problem.
Right. And actually, speaking of Cineplex, they were very smartly, I think, incorporated that into like one of these little ads they put before the movie about Talk, where with the guy crunching the popcorn and all of a sudden he vanishes.
Yeah. And so I think it also probably doesn't come as a surprise to people that like the sound design of movies is something I'm really into. That's why I love the Transformers movies. I've made it very clear. I go see the Transformers movies to hear the sound. And so I love this. Like, I love, because there are totally empty spaces, because sometimes we do switch to the daughter's sort of point of view, except it's point of sound.
Point of sound.
So there's absolutely no sound. But all of the rest of the time, like, how much work it must be to do Foley so that we don't feel totally disconnected, but yet it's quiet enough and we can understand that, oh, they're doing this really quietly. And then the sound of the monsters was so, like, it's just amazing. And then the music. Now, I know some people have read some people who are unhappy with the score, not because the score isn't good, but just the fact that it exists. Because score, which is another thing I really like in movies, very much helps the audience understand how to feel in certain places. And there are so many films that once you take the score out and you watch it and you're like, this, what, I don't, like, the acting or the script does not actually tell me how to feel about this, but the music really does. And so some people think that having put so much score in this film really took away from what were really amazing performances also. Like, it probably could have stood without the score. I do think that the caliber of the filming and everything would have stood without it, but the score is so good. And the reality is that
it's subtle too.
Yeah.
It's not overblown.
And like, there are so many, because it's so quiet, the sound will be extra, like, there's just, you're always tense because we're always trying to be quiet.
Yeah.
So the score actually helped to release some of that tension. There were a number of jump scares that weren't really typical jump scares in the way any other horror movie would do it. They're jump scares because of the sound, because of the noise.
Yeah.
And so it just helps to remind us, like, oh, yes, okay. the tension is building right now and something is going to happen.
Well, the movie lays out very early on what the price of sound is, so that when you hear a sound, you know what's
coming.
What's coming, right. And I think I can understand the point of view about having the score too, but I mean, it's, you know, to what you said, there has to be something there to kind of fill the emotional vacuum that, you know, that can't be expressed with noise. Or, you know, there's a scene in this where the daughter gets like frustrated about, you know, she feels like she's blamed for the death of her younger brother. And you know, you can't vocal, like, when you think of someone getting frustrated, you think of like noise, you think of like huge action and expressions and pacing and you can't do that in this world. So all that frustration has to be internalized.
Yeah.
And that's a hard sell. And so you do need another way to tap into that, at least for the audience. And I found this very interesting in watching this with the audience. Everyone was quiet.
Yeah.
People shut the F up watching this movie. Because I don't have like bad theater stories generally. But, you know, there is, for the most part, you know, interaction with the audience. Even just like, who is that guy? You know, those kind of people. Yeah. But here, everyone was fixated and everyone seemed to have this psychological sympathy for the characters, mm-hmm. that, you know, they have to be quiet. We have to be quiet too.
Yeah.
Which was incredibly bizarre. Like, there were people who had to get up and go to the bathroom, but you didn't hear the door slam.
You couldn't hear anything, I know.
People, so I have this image of people sort of gingerly closing the door behind them as they were leaving the theater. It was, and that speaks to, you know, the value of still of the communal movie experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, you know, you have your super ticket and that's fine. And I will definitely watch this again on home video. But
it will be a different experience.
I wonder how it'll play in the living room versus in the big cavernous movie theater.
Yeah. Coming back to the fact that nobody really talks, the communication that has to happen between these family members and, you know, the daughter who feels that she's being blamed. It's interesting, of course, because a tragedy has obviously befallen this family, and everybody internalizes their feelings about it because there is literally no way to talk about it or to express it. There's, you know, you can tell as people are interacting with each other and as they're touching that they're trying to express care and love, and I'm not going to say forgiveness because I don't think anybody blames other people, but they all blame themselves.
They all blame themselves.
So it's just so fascinating to me as a psychological sort of thing to watch grief play out. And it just, like, all those things that happen in grief for every human just becomes so much bigger in this film because none of them can work through it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like, oh, I've felt that. And this character has that now for 300 days, has lived with that and has never been able to release it.
Mm-hmm.
How damaging must that be?
Yeah, and I mean, the struggle is real. And there are a couple of scenes where they actually can, because of circumstances, talk to a couple of characters can talk to each other. And the act of talking, it just feels so raw to be actually able to express thought in words beyond the sign language they use. It feels stilted in a way. It feels almost foreign that when you actually hear English being spoken from one human to another, that's incredible. I mean, this movie makes you think about, sound and language and communication in very interesting ways. And, you know, to what you said about all the characters blaming themselves, one of the things I thought was great was John Krasinski's performance, because almost every scene in this movie, he has this like look on his face of just like
carrying everything.
Yeah, it's like, how am I going to get to the next day, and how are we going to overcome this challenge, and how do I keep the kids safe? How do I keep my wife and my newborn safe? And it's pretty far. It's far, like, as far as you can get from, you know, good old smug Jim on The Office.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't think he was capable of good acting, but, you know, the cost of the daily struggle, he wears that on his face fairly well. And that's another reason why I like that moment with him and the wife and in the basement slow dancing. And it's something, a bit of a relief for him to just stop for a moment and not have that worry in front of him.
Yeah.
And one of the things I find interesting, and as reading IMDb about, you know, how it came about, how Krasinski came aboard, how Emily Blunt came on board, and she was going to suggest someone else, but then she read the script and was like, okay, I want to be a part of this too. And it's interesting because when you see a lot of Hollywood couples in movies together, I find that the coupleness really doesn't translate. You know, if you watch something like Eyes Wide Shut, where it's, you know, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman were married at the time.
I think there are reasons it didn't.
Think at that point there was stuff going on. But even if you go back and watch something like Far and Away, it's something about that couple doesn't click together. And so you see that with a lot of different couples. When they're on screen together, the whatever makes them attracted to one another when they're in private, whatever chemistry there is, seems to get zapped. But watching Krasinski and Blunt together, that they really did feel like a couple and really felt believable. And I'm not sure that was like the story or whatever they brought to it, but it's that was a really I'm surprised it worked mm-hmm. so well is I guess what I'm getting at, but it did, you know, because Emily Blunt is always
good. Yeah, and they've never
good.
Worked together, so.
No.
Yeah.
They haven't.
It's likely that anybody watching this would not think that they were a couple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, oh, it's just two actors, and wow, they've got really great mm-hmm. chemistry. They really, you mm-hmm. know, they played these characters well.
Yeah.
And and you're right, like that is actually a testament because it didn't feel like a Hollywood couple working together. It felt like two actors doing a really good, like each doing a really good job playing their character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did, coming back to the whole, you know, the living after and creating life after some sort of tragedy has happened, I do like the fact, you know, they do sort of let us see that there are 5, 6, maybe 7 other
right.
families or outposts or whatever
yep.
around there.
I like that, yeah.
So there is community in some way, but because they can't even, like, you can't talk to each other, so just creating that community within the family is so difficult.
Yeah.
So the only thing they really do to sort of tell the other people, like, yes, we're here, we're still here, is just those fires.
Right, to light the little beacon
yeah.
at the end of every day.
And it's interesting to me that they don't work together a little bit more, but I think probably they just haven't evolved past. They're so close to the, okay, we're past survival, we're starting to live,
right.
and hopefully the next step is then we're going to start creating community with the people around us.
Well, that makes you think about a lot of things, because You know, if you're coming over to my house or I'm going over to your house, you know, what would you do? Well, we would like talk on the phone and, mm-hmm. you know, so I'll be there at 3 and then I would go to your house and I would knock on your door or ring your doorbell. You can't do any of that.
Yeah.
So how do you create that community? And you know, how do you establish that you are not an intruder if you can't say like, I'm not here to hurt you or not meet you or mm-hmm. things like that? It's, you know, it's incredibly tricky, which is why, they've already obviously been talking about a sequel to this. It's been so successful that, mm-hmm. you know, there are still places that you can investigate in this world. And, you know, what does this world look like on day 600 or 800
yeah.
or 1,000? Of course, it's also teased at the end that countermeasures have been found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's... It there is a lot to explore here. It reminds me a lot of, and not to make a direct comparison, but the Purge universe, where
yeah.
it's, you know, it's a really great idea. The first movie does a lot, and not to say that the original Purge movie is as good as A Quiet Place. It's not.
It's definitely not. But I understand the world building.
The world building lends itself that we can go to crazy new places and explore things and. Real opportunity here. I'm glad that, of course, they're talking this week. It was being looked at as maybe being turned into a Cloverfield movie. Thank God someone, you know, had the wisdom to not go that
mm-hmm.
way.
But I can see how they could have tied it into
sure.
the universe. I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah.
But
things can be allowed to stand on their own.
Yes,
and
it's true.
I read an interview with Krasinski and Blunt, and they're saying, like, you know, because they were both up for Marvel Universe parts. Emily Blunt was the original Black Widow before
mm-hmm.
Scarlett Johansson was cast. And John Krasinski was one of the potential Captain Americas. And they were saying, like, we couldn't stop everything and do something like A Quiet Place if we were having to go from one Marvel adventure to another. And
mm-hmm.
It's a powerful reminder that, you know, not only can these movies still be made, but they can be incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, sometimes great horror voices come from unexpected places, because we had Jordan Peele with Get Out last
yeah.
year. Now we have John Krasinski with A Quiet Place. So you wonder which funny person is going to create the next great horror
well,
story.
Well, and you know what? I mean, comedy and horror have a lot in common in the execution, because
mm-hmm.
it's 100% about timing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about building up the tension or build, like, drawing out and then the you know, giving the punchline or the jump
the
scare or
yeah.
whatever. Yeah. So they're very, very similar. So I'm not surprised that people who do comedy are also so good at horror.
Mm.
It does... I am intrigued to know... So the two guys who wrote this screenplay, Scott Beck and I don't remember the other guy's name. But they're like, this is really sort of the first.
Scott Beck and Brian Woods.
Brian Woods. So this is really the first like major thing they've done. It seems like all their other ones are sort of shorts, independently made, that sort of thing. So, you know, how much of it was their script versus how much of it was John Krasinski's direction?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I'm interested to see what comes next for both the you know, writers to see what they go and write next, and for John Krasinski to see what he directs next, to see how much of it was just this the magic between the three of them all working together and how much of it was sort of individual.
And this isn't John Krasinski's first movie either. I haven't seen either of his two other movies, but so it almost feels like a directorial debut in a lot of ways. But yeah, he's an interesting figure because now he's going on to like Jack Ryan, which is the new show based on the Tom Clancy character, and you know, it's funny to think of Jim from The Office, who's now like an action star and major horror prestige director, and it speaks to a lot about, you know, taking chances on people and, you know, to expect the unexpected, and I this you know, the, A Quiet Place does definitely reward those who, you know, are looking for cool, unique cinematic experiences, and in the walls of the cinema, as we said,
I will also say the score, honest to God, I listened to the score almost all day on Wednesday. I saw the film on Tuesday night. I listened to the score almost all day on Wednesday. I put it on again on Friday just to, I know I'm a little weird, but I put it on to relax. I just find like it's so fantastic. It's so good. But I do listen to horror scores to relax and to focus. That's just who I am. But this one has definitely, it's so good. It's so good.
And I'm not usually a fan of Marco Beltrami either, but sometimes he pulls it out. I do have... I hesitate to say I have a couple of nitpicks. I thought there was too much monster in it.
Do you know what? Actually, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I did walk out saying, I'm surprised that they showed the monster so clearly, and I'm also surprised that the monster looked as good as it did. Now, it was done by Industrial Light and Magic, so they did spend money on the special effects.
They got the top shelf guys.
Yeah, so I was surprised that I found it to be like, oh, okay. It reminded me of the monster effects from The Thing, if they had been done 38 years later. So, I mean, I don't think that it was too much monster, but I am surprised by how much they showed.
Yeah, I mean, the comparisons have been made to Signs, the Shyamalan Alien movie.
Yeah.
And even at the end of that, they didn't, you know, when you saw the creature in full, it was still in shadow. And then most of the rest of the time, it was usually through a glass or off a reflective surface. And it's just, you know, I did like the shot of like the big ears of the creature because it makes you understand just how evolutionarily it was built to sort of be the monster it is. But yeah, I thought there was too much monster. And the other thing that I found myself bizarrely focused on is you see, like in a lot of post-apocalyptic movies, you see the newspaper headlines that say, you know, like monsters and like it's sound.
Who was printing these?
Thank you. I have been in a printing press room.
Yeah.
And that thing is not quiet. So they're printing off this newspaper with a big headline that says it's sound. And it's, how did you run it off? One of the silent printing presses, New York Post? I hardly think so.
Well, and that's why, you know, I think there could be story to be told previous about, like, what happened on day one. Because obviously it didn't happen all around the world at the same time. It must have happened in certain places.
But it happened quickly, what kind of one inferred, because it starts on day 40 and everything already everything's gone to blank.
I think it was day 80, wasn't it?
Oh, maybe. You might be right.
Either way, 80 days is still not very long.
80 days is a like very quick time frame for society to go to pot. But, you know, those were kind of my nitpicks. But otherwise,
I definitely agree. I did watch that. I was like, what is going on? And then I was a little concerned about where they get, how are they getting all this power? I wasn't so much concerned, but I was like, oh, they have power and they're not going to explain why. That's fine. I can move beyond it.
I think you see solar panels when they're on the silo and it's looking out over the farm. There's solar panels there, I think.
That was still a lot of power. Either way, it doesn't really matter.
Well, wasn't a lot of people around who still using power, so.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean.
It's a good thing he was a engineer of some sort.
Yeah, it's a good thing
getting these books to find out? Like, there are definitely questions, but at the same time, for the art, like, I was totally willing to just go, okay, yeah, whatever. He went to the library. That's fine.
John Krasinski was too good at surviving the apocalypse. Well, we're losing the thread, because the point of the situation, it was a very good movie, and well worth seeing if you haven't already. Anyway, we will be back here next week for more end credits, and in the meantime, you can listen to our show at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and at End Credits Radio on the Twitter. And Candace, in case you still have some things left to promote, would you like to promote some things?
Well, just in case you weren't taking notes earlier. So you can check me out on the internet everywhere at Sinn48, C-I-N-N-4-8, and definitely listen to an episode of the Village Podcast by The Bookshelf, where sometimes we talk about post-apocalyptic futures.
Bookmark that one. Anyway, I will be on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with my partner, Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram in the meantime at Adam McDonaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And you can stay tuned for more stuff here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And like I said, we'll be back here again Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. We'll see you then.